Okay, we're back for another episode of Powers and Principalities, episode 105. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. Unfortunately, the First Amendment is not doing too well this week. YouTube was on a rampage, and it's kind of interesting because, you know, we had discussed talking about suffrage, universal suffrage. There's an important anniversary coming up relating to it. But the activity in YouTube does kind of blend into some of these themes. So I was wondering, could you describe what happened and maybe give us some of your thoughts about YouTube?
Well, yeah, the very day you sent me that piece, I got notices that several of my videos, about a dozen or so, that had been restricted for its content that violated community standards, had been pulled off entirely from the internet. And this also coincided with the piece you sent me. I guess it was a newspaper or magazine from Great Britain.
Yes.
Was it the Statesman?
Well, Independent.
The Independent. That was it. Yeah. There's this purge now. Now they're, I guess they have different standards or criterion for shutting down accounts or pulling videos off and demonetizing people, these things. And they set the, apparently, YouTube said that hate speech is not allowed on YouTube. We remove content promoting violence or hatred against individuals or groups of any of the following attributes. And they have age. So you can't criticize baby boomers, I suppose. Caste. So I guess, you know, this is in India. I don't know. Disability, ethnicity, gender identity, nationality, race, immigration status. Okay, religion, sex/gender, I guess that's different from gender identity, sexual orientation, victims of major violent events and their kin. So I don't know who they're talking about there. I guess maybe the entire world.
Well, that's true, but I mean, I think it's also like perhaps there, anyone, if you question the Sandy Hook parents, for example, if you're
Okay, that's true, yes, because I've noticed that's been an interesting thing. Where a couple of years ago, that became a pretext. I mean, I think James Tracy was run out of his job at University of, University down in Florida. But just, you know, broaching the topic of false flags, it became a reason to pull videos off. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I guess hate speech is, what they consider hate speech is, it's just criticism, critique, or analysis, or anything that's entertaining a competing narrative of various events. And they don't really define hate speech. Hate speech is just criticism. So if you criticize a group or their organizations, that's hate speech. And that's hatred. It's one of these things. Basically, what they're doing is they're saying is everyone, in the interest of preventing everyone from having their feelings hurt, they're not going to allow criticism on YouTube. Of course, that's they'll allow the, the normal narratives and criticisms you hear in the standard media. I mean, I don't think if there's a group criticizing, intolerance for things like homosexuality, traditional teachings of the Catholic Church, that's not going to get pulled. So they're being very highly selective because this pretty much renders YouTube useless, worthless, really, for what it's supposed to be. Now, a lot of people, I've read somewhere that this crackdown has destroyed the algorithm for its ad features. And YouTube itself, the company, has lost about $9 billion because of this. And I hear a lot of people saying, well, this is YouTube cutting its own throat because they're losing revenue. But the fact of the matter is that YouTube and Google and big tech, there are subsidiaries of the deep state, or the deep state is a subsidiary of them. It's all one kind of overlapping organization or series of organizations. They all work together, and the deep state is very deep pockets, you know, practically bottomless. So I don't think it's about profit or making dollars. That's you know, ultimately it's about, you know, control and imposing this the high-tech slave state. And so they simply cannot tolerate all the talk and free talk on YouTube. It's what they call, you know, guess what someone would have called back in the 70s, the crisis of democracy, meaning that people are getting too uppity and they're getting too well informed, and this has to be changed. And that's, the censorship is obvious, and the fact that there's any government action shows that the government is the government, or the people who control the government, the federal government, and it's not the voters, as we talk about, you know, the voting today, the universal suffrage, particularly with female suffrage. They're farming out censorship because they don't like the fact that word is getting out about various things. You know, so it's obvious. I mean, it's almost it is laughable because it's their little excuses. Just, you know, I mean, they're transparently false.
Yeah, they are transparently false, and basically, it's, you can see mind control in a dynamic sense. In other words, when you look at their description of what they're pulling, they're definitely trying to shape the minds of the viewers. And so when you talk about YouTube being what I would call like a Brave New World company, all of the Brave New World companies are organized around slavery, basically, through, you know, intellectual domination and intimidation. And so when you see companies that don't make any money, like Amazon and Tesla, right, then you can think, well, they're expanding, they're getting access to credit because they fulfill some function in the technological slave state, right? So when YouTube is losing money because the algorithm doesn't work anymore, I mean, if you've like signed up for, you know, some kind of revenue stream based on your video, and then you find that it got somehow intersected with this hate speech stuff. Mm-hmm. You were never apprised of it. There was no kind of process. I mean, I would think on the grounds of just access to business opportunity, this is grounds for a lawsuit, because they basically bait and switch the people to come into YouTube, and then they change the rules once these people are now trying to commercially function, and they've done it in just an arbitrary manner. But unfortunately, it won't go anywhere. You're not going to see like a big hue and cry against YouTube for doing this, because the hue and cry would come from the media, like the Washington Post. And so the only hue and cry you're going to hear about any of this is from shows like us, which have somehow been able to dodge the bullet and are not haven't been pulled yet. But people who listen to us, I think you can all see the handwriting on the wall. I mean, Tim and I are trying to have open discussions. You know, I mean, we try, and yet that's the very reason why I think there's our future is threatened, because this would go against the kind of intellectual structure of slavery that these guys are setting up. So. I was astonished when I saw the first day when the YouTube did the performed their maneuver and they pulled everything. They gave a list of all of the people who had been basically really hammered. It appeared on Zero Hedge, and it was a short list. It was only maybe 30, YouTube personalities and websites, and one of them was E. Michael Jones. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, E. Michael Jones is probably the most nuanced and, sort of objective researcher that we have. And there's nothing in him that can be seen as hateful or driven by hate. This is just, it's really sort of almost ridiculous, that someone like that would be so shattered by YouTube. I don't know exactly what extent his material was pulled or what's left, but I saw him as one of the major targets.
Yeah,
of
the, yeah. The irony is he's like an unofficial ambassador for peace with like countries like Iran, and he openly calls for no violence, no harming. I mean, no violence to anybody. But then if you're an advocate for war with Iran, you know, if you're a policy wonk.
Hate-filled neocon.
Yeah, a neocon working for the American Enterprise Institute. They'll post your video about, you know, what we can do to start drum up a war with Iran or something. And, you know, it's interesting is that, you know, they say they're a platform and they're not a publishing house. Well, no, they're acting now because they're acting like they're a publishing outfit, not a platform. And which means they can be held responsible for the content. So they're playing a double game here. So, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, the reason they're able to grow so much because they were given special treatment by the government with the Communications Decency Act back in the 90s. And they're not being, you know, I mean, if you look at, this is the public square. This is where people come to communicate and talk. And I've heard one guy compare it to the telephone company back in the 70s. If the telephone company had been able to pinpoint, you know, been monitoring everyone's phone conversations, and they found that there was a white nationalist or a white supremacist or a white separatist or anyone voicing an opinion that was considered outside the mainstream and hateful, could the phone company deny them? Could the phone company have denied that person phone service? And the way the Telecommunications Act read, no, it could not, based on just a political point of view. So the internet's the same thing. And if they're going to start shutting down YouTube and other platforms, you know, theoretically they could deny anyone even email service, banking, and it's, you know, and this is done unofficially. You could deny access to banking. If you're not a good citizen, they're rolling this out in China with the social credit system, and they're kind of doing a little bit here now. We're getting a taste of it, where if you're not a good citizen, you won't be able to travel and you won't be able to access credit or financial institutions to do purchases. And this is what, you know, electronic currency is all about in the final analysis. And so what they're going to say is if you're a bad person, you will be effectively ostracized, but it's not a violation of the First Amendment because it's not the government doing it.
Right, exactly. and so when you look at, like, say, Amazon and how it's not, you know, just dominating but destroying all of these different kinds of deliveries businesses that were part of the people's commerce and are now being replaced by the Brave New World companies, you know, you can see why it was able to grow to its extent even though it had supposedly no revenue, right? I mean, it's 100% clear that when you then look at how Amazon can function hand in hand with YouTube, right? I mean, just think about how easy it is going to be to organize all this. You can really see the technological slave state, the components of it getting developed, right? You won't be able to, you know, you talk about no access to credit. Well, how about no access to food?
Well, which is... effectively, that's what they, yeah, access to, yeah, that's what they'd be doing with that, yeah.
Sure. And so that's where it's going. You're going to basically the Brave New World where they have access, they have what's called full spectrum dominance.
Yeah, especially with Terminator seeds. You have to, every year, you have to buy seeds from them, even if you're growing your own crops.
Yeah, that's right. Just to digress, that's one of the reasons why here in our community we have what's called seed swaps. And we get together and everybody exchanges their seeds. So that you can have non-GMO, non-PAT, non-Monsanto seeds that are in circulation and are still functioning. I mean, it's you know, and I mean, there's 1,000 people takes part in it. So that's an example of a kind of rebellion. I don't know how long term that'll work, but this is at least something. So it's all going to come together over the head of the diminished human in the future, right? Who's Epsilon Delta. I mean, just think of that kind of life. They'll be, you know, an IQ of about 70, perhaps. Their ideas will have been basically selected, Right. They will have just been never even, you know, there would have been no opportunity to any kind of ideas about rebellion or anything that is malevolent in the current system. And it'll be a perfect system in terms of the oligarchs. They will not have to worry about rebellion. Basically, it'll be a technologic feudal system where the technology gets even into the production of the semi-humans who will make up the slave class until the robots replace them all. And so I would say, Tim, that vision is so clear cut at this point, it's hardly even a prediction. I mean, the elements are really starting to be placed into operation.
Yeah. And what's hateful? I mean, it all depends on what you decide is hateful. I think it's hateful to promote degenerate behavior, because it's ultimately that leads to people's destruction, physical and spiritual. We're now, nothing's really neutral in it. There was a time when things were kind of neutral. You could go to the grocery store, you didn't see anything political. Or you could watch late night comedy, and it was only marginally political, and the politics wasn't really partisan. It was more based on personality or something. You know, like the old Johnny Carson show or something, where now the late night idiots are just, you know, they're so partisan. And I'm not saying because they criticize Trump. I'm just saying it's just so political. And of course, that connection was exposed with the WikiLeaks with the Colbert, with Stephen Colbert, and he was working, with the Clinton campaign.
Right.
I mean, that's how close it is. And that's a partisan example. Just little things. I don't know if you're familiar. There's a company called Zillow. It's real estate.
Sure.
That's right. You're familiar with this. Well, I'm getting my email feed because I would just, occasionally I look at houses around, as I look around. So I get onto someone's email list. And Zillow as a corporation sent out an email, just a general email, about Zillow taking part in pride parades. Now Zillow is in the real estate. Why are we getting involved in this issue? It's promoting pride. And I look at, and they have these little graphic art, and the two little human-like figures they have. One is two women, so I guess it's lesbian. One's black, one's white. So interracial and homosexual. And then this shows two guys, I think both were white, but they have like a boy, like that's their son. And they're promoting this. This is Zillow. Now, if corporations are into mass marketing and appealing to the lowest common denominator and creating the broadest markets possible, and the fact that even today, the vast majority of people do not agree with that. In fact, they're probably bothered by it, get them in an honest moment. But to be instructed that these feelings, which are completely justifiable and natural, are somehow no longer are considered like hateful and beyond the pale and outside the Overton window, which is becoming narrower and narrower, or broader, depends how you look at that. But anyway, the whole point is that they're just trying to sell houses. Why would they be pushing that? And then they push gayborhoods. I'm not kidding.
They push gayborhoods.
What is gayborhoods? Are neighborhoods with homosexuals, and these are neighborhoods with a higher percentage of homosexuals tend to be recently gentrified neighborhoods, urban settings, these things, and how you can invest in these gayborhoods. And this is being promoted by the corporation. We talked a while back, a couple of weeks ago, about the corporations that are backing the transgender agenda. Why would they be doing this? And, this is a complete agenda. And, to me, that is hateful to humanity's well-being. So why is that being tolerated?
Right. I saw an interesting commercial. It was a Coca-Cola commercial, and it was basically promoting love, kind of, and mm-hmm. how Coke interacts with love. And it was neuro-linguistic programming. It showed probably in 60 seconds, I'm going to guess, and I don't, quote me in these numbers, but I'm going to say like several hundred couples. But they were occurring so quickly, that you couldn't really, your brain couldn't focus on them.
Mm-hmm.
They were all basically mixed gender and mixed race couples are, a large fraction. And you could easily see that Coke, whoever was designing the ad, was deliberately trying to get at the subconscious of the viewer, right?
Sure.
They were trying to normalize these configurations. And they're doing so for a purpose. I mean, how could it be even lost to the most kind of the least intellectually ambitious normie on the planet at this point, that this is the agenda. This is not history unfolding. What is unfolding is an operation And the target is basically the heterosexual European family.
I mean,
that is now they also target the heterosexual Asian family and the heterosexual African descendant family, just so that people know that I'm not a bigot. So they don't like heterosexuality at all.
It's just that the black family hardly exists anymore in the United States.
So. Well, that's right, exactly. And so, but you see, I was going to make the example, like if you say, well, I don't want a transgender teacher of my second grade child, and the principal is aghast. Why not? And it says, well, because I really want to have that my child participate in a heterosexual family when they get older, because this is what I came from, and this is my opinion as the best kind of lifestyle that my child can experience, right? This is just my opinion, and so that's why I don't want that role model in front of him, because I think it'll confuse him on the path that I hope he or she follows. Now, this position would be what would be hate speech.
Yeah, and I would say, I don't want a transvestite teaching my kids. I don't trust them. Someone with that affliction or that psychological disorder or confusion should not be entrusted with children. This is not you don't have a right to be a teacher. That's a position of trust that you earn through not only through earning a certificate, but also through your good behavior. You're a moral person. You can be trusted with young people. That's a normal, common sense requirement for a job like that. You're in loci parentis. I mean, you're trusting your children, your precious children, with other adults, and you have to earn their trust. The fact that this person is so confused and thinks that he can, not only is he confused, he thinks he's right to impose it on your children in the school system. And the fact that the principal doesn't acknowledge the problem here means that I don't want you as the principal because you're an idiot.
Well, there is the public school system.
Yes.
And this is why the choice just couldn't be clearer at this point. The public schools, you know, are part of the operation.
Yeah.
I mean, there is just, I know there are teachers inside the cities that are absolutely heroic, who are trying their absolute level best to, give the disadvantaged kids the very best education. They're trying basically to work against the whole structure of society that is crushing these kids. But the fact is that if they don't stop and try to analyze the gender orientation operation that they're being told that, they have to manifest in the classroom, they are becoming part of an operation that they just don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, even if their heart is pure as gold, and I know many of them are, they are still becoming part of an operation that is malevolent. It was, it's sort of like the Great Society programs. You know, we can go back now and show the malevolence, show the design, and you can look at it statistically as the thing moves forward in time and destroys the African-American family. You can see it's deliberate. Well, what we're in the process of now is the same thing in terms of just broad-based sexual orientation. And it's from the same group, and it's just as malevolent as the destruction of the African-American heterosexual family was in the 60s.
Yeah, and the fact that someone has to be a dissident teacher, that begs the question, doesn't it, about the system itself. And why are we lavishing the system with hundreds of billions of dollars a year in tax dollars? You know, that's why we need a wider consciousness of this. It isn't good enough to say, I support education. Well, what are they? This is indoctrination, and this is mind control. It is not education anymore. And that's the fact that school systems all around the country put up with people like that in the school system, open homosexuals or transvestites, these things. These are people that should not be entrusted with children. The fact that it's a topic on people's minds means that they're acting in bad faith, because that should not even be an issue. It's like the gay scout leader, right? Why are you even talking about it? The fact you even bring this up as a right means you shouldn't be in this organization, because you're not, this is not something you talk about with kids, at the very least.
The gay, I've always wondered about that, how people can be so naive. I mean, you wouldn't have, or you would be very cautious about putting a young male in charge of teenage girls on overnight hikes in the
woods. I know, yeah.
Wouldn't that be something that the parents would go, well, you know, frankly, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. It's not hate speech. It's just as parents behaving like they're supposed to in terms of, you know, their role. But if it's the reverse, if you go, well, I'm not comfortable with someone of that sexual orientation with my, you know, 12-year-old boy in the woods for a 3-day, you know, trip. I mean, well, you'll get your ass sued.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, if you take someone who's young, let's say pure and naive, and you throw them into a degenerate situation, that's a recipe for tragedy. They need to be protected from that. So you have to trust these people.
Well, Tim, but again, this is the operation. These things are not coming about spontaneously. These structures have been put into motion by broad stroke legal power, backed up by broad stroke media conditioning, you know, backed up by broad stroke educational control. All of these things work together so that, you know, the parent is just crushed under this intimidation, right? Legal, you know, educational. And they just can't perform the normal structure of being a parent. You know, they say, no, I'm sorry, I don't trust. Look, it's like you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, that when you're in loci parentis, I believe is the expression, you have to earn that trust.
Yeah.
Every parent should demand. So it is the highest standard of trust that exists in this world.
You have a right to access to my child?
The idea that well, it should just be handed over without any contestation, without any process, is the operation.
It's like it's almost as if I was looking, let's say I take my wife out to dinner and we want to hire a babysitter and some transvestite shows up demanding that I hire him or it to watch my kids. If I don't, I'm being hateful. I'm violating, you know, I'd be violating the Equality Act. The bill that's out.
Yeah.
No. And this is the thing, is the reason why they want this, they want this sexual confusion, this so-called liberation, to not only to engage in all types of degenerate sexual behavior, whether it's, you know, promiscuous behavior, even identifying as something you're not and then dressing like that or acting like that, whatever, is the reason why, you know, big capital corporations, governments, because this is the ultimate atomization, the sort of the you destroy someone's identity. They can't relate to their family, their extended family. That with that, they'll have a community. So when the single mother who's working hard to raise her kid finds out the kid's having trouble at school because the teacher is a cross-dresser, she doesn't even have a husband to back her up, and she just has to resign to it. And that they want more families like that, and even the families that are intact, they're alone. They're in a community.
They're not families. I mean,
there's no community because communities were broken up.
Actually, it's just a mom and child. It's a half family.
You can't form a posse. And really, you have to form a posse and threaten these people, really threaten their well-being, because they're doing that to you. I mean, they have to feel that the jobs are at stake, and ultimately their physical safety is at stake if they keep it up, because then there's consequences. That's the only threat they're going to respond to, unfortunately. You're not going to appeal to their good nature or their reason on these things.
I mean, it is. I always think that it's the temptation for vigilantism of different kinds is overwhelming. But I just think that of course, self-defense is always permitted, and self-defense of the child is always permitted, you know, in my opinion. But the policy of vigilantism has to be very carefully.
Oh, of course, yes. It has to be discretion.
You'll just run right into the how they will present that. It won't be an effective political. I don't know exactly what would be effective political activity, you know, but I just trust in the capacity for reason. And I think that the information revolution, just explaining the malevolence,
you try to do that, but then YouTube shuts
your... Touche. Well, I have a question then. Mm-hmm. So suffrage, was that, you know, you mentioned you can see all of these aspects of the current operation to bring about the brave new technologic slave state. Was suffrage a step in that direction? Was it part of the operation way back when? What was involved in the creation of suffrage?
Well, broadly speaking, the voting, the right to vote, the universal suffrage, tended to expand as the United States became more oligarchy. So there's a connection there, meaning the more control that the elites got, the greater the illusion was necessary to give people give people the vote, so they had the illusion of some sort of participation. But the biggest, obviously, this 1919 was the year that the 19th Amendment was proposed, was ultimately passed in 1920. So we're coming up on 100 years, a century of women voting in the United States. That's at the federal level. The 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution, just, I got this from various sources. So this is kind of a narrative, standard narrative. The 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits the states and federal government from denying the right to vote to citizens of the United States on the basis of sex. Initially introduced to Congress in 1878, several attempts to pass a women's suffrage amendment failed until 1919, when suffragists pressed President Woodrow Wilson to call a special congressional session. On May 21, 1919, the proposed amendment passed the House of Representatives, followed by the Senate on June 4, 1919, before it was submitted to the states for ratification. Once again, suffragists mobilized to lobby state legislatures to approve the amendment. On August 18, 1920, Tennessee legislature approved the amendment, becoming the last of the necessary 36 states to secure ratification. U.S. Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby made the adoption of the 19th Amendment official on August 26, 1920, the culmination of a decades-long movement for women's suffrage at both the state and national levels. Passage of the National Suffrage Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was a long process. While women had the right to vote in several of the colonies and what would become the United States, by 1807, women had been denied even limited suffrage. By the mid-19th century, organizations supporting women's rights became more active. In 1848, Seneca Falls Convention adopted the Declaration of Sentiments, which called for equality between the sexes and included a resolution urging women to secure the vote. Organizations began to advocate for the vote using a variety of tactics, including legal arguments that relied on existing amendments. After those arguments were struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, suffrage organizations, along with activists like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, called for a new constitutional amendment that would guarantee women the right to vote. By the late 19th century, new states and territories, particularly in the West, began to grant women the right to vote. In 1878, Senator Aaron A. Sargent introduced to Congress a suffrage proposal that would eventually become the 19th Amendment, but it was rejected in 1887. By the 1890s, suffrage organizations focused on a national amendment while still working on the state and local levels. Entry of the United States into World War I helped shift public perception of women's suffrage. That's interesting. The National American Women's Suffrage Association supported the war effort, making the case that women would be rewarded with an enfranchisement for their patriotic wartime service. So women can be warmongers too, so they can be given trust with the vote. The National Women's Party staged marches, demonstrations, and hunger strikes while pointing out the contradictions of fighting abroad for democracy while limiting it at home by denying women the right to vote. So make the world safe for democracy. Let's see. Of course, there was anti-suffragism too. Anti-suffragism was a political movement composed of both men and women that began in the late 19th century in order to campaign against women's suffrage in countries such as Australia, Canada, Ireland, United Kingdom, and the United States. Anti-suffragism was largely a conservative movement that sought to keep the status quo for women, which opposed the idea of giving women equal suffrage rights. It was closely associated with domestic feminism, the belief that women had the right to complete freedom within the home. In the United States, these activists were often referred to as remonstrants or antis. So that's interesting that people forget there was a very vocal and power, influential anti-suffragette movement as well, saying it basically it was a bad idea to get women directly into politics, and this would disrupt the family, sow discord between man and wife. Some said it would, well, actually, I can maybe read that later. There is an argument against it. Maybe perhaps I'll read part of it later on in our discussion. So that's kind of what happened, how women got the right to vote in the United States. It was gradual. They could vote in various states. And 1920, they got the right to vote in federal elections. And the rest, as they say, is history. So now we have universal suffrage for men and women, and how has it affected the political system? Are we freer? Is it more democratic? Is there more accountability in government? Did it keep government small and responsible? And how have things worked out?
Yeah, it's worked out great, hasn't it? Gosh. And it's worked out great for women, too. I'm being sarcastic. This actually is sort of the continuation of the conversation we had about the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It was always simply an illusion to give to the citizens that there was some kind of political power that they had access to. And they thought they did because they got to choose between, this neocon or male neocon or so the choices were artificial, and the people who were creating the legal structure were able to put on the facade of democracy because they had control over who would be selected, the group that would be selected from. And so when you have the original voting bloc, I'm sure that they did analysis of what can we create as a republic in terms of the voting, structure to be absolutely sure that we can control it. And so you had this property provision of landowners. So that was the first restriction of voting. But I think obviously this was done because it was the Masonic plurality. This was they knew they had control over that, and so they would that there would be no distinction between the Masonic Lodge political structure and the structure that was being represented as, what democracy was producing. And it's really kind of funny, isn't it, just to digress, that the people were supposed to come to Washington D.C., which is just designed as a big Masonic, symbol. So there really wasn't a whole lot of question about, what was really going on with the original voting structure of the United States. As we discussed, it was just a facade. And so then as the country becomes more populated, I'm sure that the changes that were made and the different people that were let in, they represent basically new levels of control that, the secret society had, that where they could be sure that, if they let non-landowning males vote, this also took place in Britain, where they mm-hmm. had the property restrictions. But over time, they were able to get rid of these things to create more and more illusion about, don't complain about the fact that you're a slave and you have no money because you get to vote. Mm-hmm. But actually, if you look at, who's controlling the money and the printing press and the candidates, there's less democracy in the United States and in Britain than there was probably in, Imperial Rome,
Yeah, as the voting rights expand, government becomes more secretive. You get the cryptocracy. I'm not just talking about the national security state, CIA, OSS, secret, covert organizations, secret organizations. But even the banking system becomes secretive and Masonic. And there's no control over that, but you can vote.
So this is the thing, is that one of the really hard things to get the normie to turn around on is this illusion that there's something beneficial about the voting process. It's a really hard concept, hard for people to get their head around. They think that this is, this is where they can make changes. But mm-hmm. Obviously the quality of democracy is about zero. And we need to make changes in it, but not the changes that are being given to us. We need to go into the structure of the thing. And starting with DNA testing of all of the candidates, so that we can make sure we're not just voting for a little family of malevolent secret society members. So
inbred lizard people.
Yeah, exactly. That is an expression. So the thing is that with suffrage, I think that, because it's easier to show the structure of it. It was completely Masonic, the creation of the female vote in Britain. And in fact, it's very interesting. It's actually our old friends again, the Theosophists, Annie Besant and her clique of Masonries and free and Theosophists who come from Helen Blavatsky. Really not, believe me, if there's a great, it was a PhD paper written by a woman named Anne Jessica Pilcher Dayton. And she just really just provides all this data about how suffrage was brought about by the different groups of Freemasonry and particularly the power that the Theosophists had in the creation of it. And she is to be taken seriously because she is the librarian and archivist of the Order of Women Freemasons. So she says that I have a complete access to the history of women's Freemasonry and the opportunity to examine these records. And so she has a PhD thesis called Women Freemasons and Feminist Causes, 1908-1935, The Case of the Honorable Fraternity of Ancient Masonry. And so she just shows that there wasn't really any, you know, kind of organized suffragette type movement outside of these groups. And there was more than one group, but they're all, it's just like with the creation of the Nazi Party, you've got all these disparate elements, but you just scratch the surface a little bit and oh my gosh, there's a, you know, a Masonic feminist, there's like the you know, follower of Blavatsky. And so because I don't want to bore people, the documentation that Pilcher Dayton has is just airtight. It's just extraordinary. And I would recommend people who are curious about this, it's online. The PhD thesis is online. You can just, as long as Google hasn't banned it for hate speech, you can get it and you can just read it yourself and see that, you know, my assertion is 100% correct that in Britain, the suffragette movement is a Masonic movement. Okay, that's what it was. So the question, Tim, is, well, why would they do this? Well, I mean, we know that, you know, when you look at the relationship between the Theosophists and the creation of the Nazi Party, they don't really look very much like, you know, a benevolent society. I mean, Helen Blavatsky, the mad dog, blood-soaked, red shirt follower of Garibaldi. I mean, and to digress, Blavatsky is so critical for people to understand, and it's great because even like Wikipedia level, you know, you can go there and see if you know they don't really organize well, but if you look closely, you can see what that her claim to be a spiritualist is ludicrous, right? When she came from Italy, where she had been fighting with Garibaldi, she had been so blood-soaked, she took two rounds in her body and then still was able to battle on and then took a saber sword to her arm. I mean, this was why she was selected, right? This because she was just an absolute mad dog, Masonic creature. And so she then was brought by Garibaldi. He's the one who introduced her to the Quattro Coronati, right? The guys who were working on the creation of Zionism and then eventually start to produce the Nazis. And so, and of course, well, again, it bore people, but this is where, you know, Memphis and Mizraim, that bizarre you know, stuff that the Order of the Golden Dawn and all of the mysticism that then becomes the Nazi Party come from. So Blavatsky, this is who Blavatsky is. She's not some kind of spiritualist. That's obviously ludicrous. And so when you see her helping now to create feminism, well, not just helping, but literally, being the seminal force in England to bring about this structure, I mean, Tim, it doesn't make any sense as a benevolent act. It was so it's clearly destructive. There's something going on here, and so I would just posit that it's just as you had suggested that what you're seeing is the atomization of the family. So I know that again we've sort of crossed the line, and I can you know imagine that many women who will listen to this will you know resist this and perhaps they well should, but my point is that the operation was to break up the family, and so the workers' paradise was the idea of look, you'll get to participate in the voting system, there'll be feminism, right? You'll have your self-esteem will go up, and then you'll start to find that there is these problems with families, right? Just as Marx saw problems with families and Gloria Steinem, all of these operational individuals saw the problems with families, that will then come through feminism, and you'll end up as a really happy single mom with a government check and a future of loneliness, you see. So this is, I think, the kind of the undercurrent of suffragism that I think people haven't looked at very closely, is that once you start breaking the secret society's operations into components so you can see them more clearly, you can see that that feminism and the voting, is which is the other one of the components of it, was just part of the operation.
Yeah, it's often, there's a bumper sticker I often see when I'm out and about, and it says, well-behaved women seldom make history. Well, if you look at the history of the past couple hundred years, maybe women should have behaved better, well-behaved.
Well, it wasn't in their interest.
They got
sold the workers' paradise, right? The powerful, legally protected, single workforce woman, right? Now, that's the workers' paradise. There, if it worked out, we'd have all these happy people now, because we have almost no family production, particularly we have none in the inner city. But as even the kind of white middle class now is losing the capacity to produce them. And I mean, what has this led to? Right. Where is the workers' paradise? Everyone is absolutely miserable. I've never seen, just the isolation and loneliness that people are descending into. I mean, the opioid crisis, I mean, the whole nature of our culture is headed into a negative place. And so this is the real fruits of this process that we were involved in. And as I've said many times, we should now be able to resist. When they had, when Herbert Marcuse, brought out Eros and Civilization, which was, also had a feminist component to it, right? Because he was kind of like a Marxist, where women will be free and liberated, and they'll be able to have their sexual world will be fulfilled, and it won't be some isolated family where all these bad things happen, and polysexualism is possible. That's going to be fun. Okay, well then, in the 60s and early 70s, who could resist him? Who could stand up against Marcuse and say, Herbert, it isn't just that your ideas are junk, but you're an evil person. This is an attack. This is part of the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, where it's operational. What they claimed was going to happen is now happening, and your book, Eros and Civilization, is part of it. This is an attack. You see, we didn't have the grammar, because we didn't think of the possibility that people in positions of power would actually attack other individuals inside American culture. But it did happen. It's true. It did happen. And so now, hopefully, we can see that when they give us this idea about the workers' paradise, when they talk now about the transgender movement, right? This, again, workers' paradise. It's all going to be great. We're just going to be as happy as we can be. We should have a little bit more grammar, don't you think, where we can resist this and say, maybe what we're dealing with here is a malevolent attack by evil people. You see, if we can get to that point of clarity, I think we can resist, fairly easily.
Well, you have to have the ability to identify psychological warfare and covert warfare, that it isn't just armies aren't fighting, with blue uniforms and red uniforms, and it's out in the open. This is covert, and it's psychological, and it's using advertising and manipulation and these things of emotion and sentiment. And the reality is the belief that everyone can be an individual, regardless of their sex, and be treated completely equally, is the assumption or the presumption that we're all rational actors, and we're all well informed. It's not. We're very irrational. We're very emotional, and we need the protections of various conventions and institutions and, dare I say, sacraments to protect us from these things, from the wickedness and snares of the devil. But it's interesting to point out the again, the women's suffrage in the early part of the 20th century, 1919, this followed a century-long democratic process that was happening in the United States, starting with Jackson and these things, the age of Jackson in the 1820s or 1830s, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, is this movement towards mass democracy, one man, one vote. This is a Masonic trick. And it's a movement towards enslavement and oligarchy, and that the Democratic or Republican process is just the facade. But I do think certain things, you know, obviously what was occurring, what you had roughly around the same time, World War One period, the so-called progressive era, you had democratic, the movement towards, you know, universal suffrage in general. I'm not a big fan of mass democracy, direct voting in general. So when I critique the 19th Amendment and the influence of women in politics, I kind of apply it broadly. I think bringing women into politics was a trick to undermine the family and to manipulate them, manipulate their emotions. And, you know, even advertisers admit that women are more vulnerable to these things. Isn't that men aren't? Isn't that there are a lot of dumb men out there voting, ill-informed men, and a lot of, you know, horrible male politicians. But what I've seen among the women, the stock of women politicians, I'm not encouraged to say that, to say the least. But, yeah, I mean, you had things like the direct election of senators, right? This is supposed to make government better. Okay, fine. How did that work out? You know, the 17th Amendment. And, you know, throughout the 19th century, you had, people still think we have a right to vote for president. We don't. There's no constitutional right to vote for president. We vote for electors. And there's no right to that because the states have the plenary authority to determine the manner in which electors are chosen. All the states since the 1830s, I think the last one was South Carolina to hold out, and this was after the Civil War, that they can appoint their, you could, you know, the states have the plenary authority, and you could have a system where the state legislatures appoint the electors to elect the president. So if you'd ask me about political reforms in the current system, what would be a beneficial thing? I would say take a few steps back from democracy and further remove from it. And one would be to do away with presidential elections and to have all the state legislatures elect the electors. And that way, presidential politics would be at the state level. And I do think if you return politics to a human scale, the smaller you get, the more accountable you get, the more effective it is, the more democratic it is, and less vulnerable it is, or at least more resistant it is to oligarchy. So that's one thing. Is again, all this movement towards democracy was a trick, and women, and the giving women the right to vote was part of that trick. People acknowledged this at the time. Like I said, I referred to the anti-suffragist, and there was I'll read excerpts from this. is a piece written by J.B. Sanford, chairman of the Democratic Caucus. And arguments against women's suffrage, 1911. So this is 8 years before the amendment was proposed and 9 years before it was passed. Suffrage is not a right. It is a privilege that may or may not be granted. Politics is no place for women. Consequently, the privilege should not be granted to her. For a woman. Consequently, the privilege should not be granted to her. There's a misprint there. The mother's influence is needed in the home. She can do little good by gadding the streets and neglecting her children. Let her teach her daughters that modesty, patience, and gentleness are the charms of a woman. Let her teach her sons that an honest conscience in every man's is every man's first political law, that no splendor can rob him nor force justify the surrender of the simplest right of a free and independent citizen. The mothers of this country can shape the destinies of the nation by keeping in their places and attending to their duties that God Almighty intended for them. The kindly, gentle influence of the mother in the home and the dignified influence of the teacher in the school will far outweigh all the influence of all the mannish female politicians on earth. The men are able to run the government and take care of the women. Do women have the right to vote in order to receive the protection of a man? Why, men have gone to war, endured every privation and death itself in defense of a woman. To man, woman is the dearest creature on earth, and there is no extreme to which he could not go for his mother or sister. By keeping woman in her exalted position, man can be induced to do more for her than he could by having her mix up in the affairs that will cause him to lose respect and regard for her. woman does not have to vote to secure her rights. Man will go to any extreme to protect and elevate her now. As long as a woman is a woman and keeps her place, she will get more protection and more consideration than man gets. When she abdicates her throne, she throws down her scepter of her power and loses her influence. Woman suffrage has been a proven failure in states that have tried it. It is wrong. California should profit by the mistakes of other states. Not one reform is equal, has equal suffrage affected. On the contrary, statistics go to show that in most equal suffrage states, Colorado particularly, that divorces have greatly increased since the adoption of the Equal Suffrage Amendment, showing that it has been a home destroyer. Crime has also increased due to lack of mothers in the home. Woman is woman. She cannot unsex herself or change her sphere. Let her be content with her lot and perform those high duties intended to her by the great Creator, and she will accomplish far more in governmental affairs than she can accomplish ever by mixing up in the dirty pool of politics. Keep the home pure, and all will be well in the Republic. Let not the sanctity of the home be invaded by every little politician that may be running up and down the highway for office. Let manly men and womanly women defeat this amendment and keep woman where she belongs in order that she may retain the respect of all mankind.
Right. Well, you know, I have a feeling that some women will find that as self-serving, you know, mm-hmm. for a male to take that position. The problem I have with the author's position is that it doesn't recognize the oligarchic control of the political system, that the whole political system is as fake. And so he thinks that having men involved in the political system exclusively will produce something that will eventually end up helping the woman.
Well, that self-evident isn't true, because men were, and look what happened.
Right. Yeah, there you go. But see, I think that the problem here is that federalism is a trick, and it's a, you know, workers' paradise, like three-handed Monty thing, that people see that this is some glorious manifestation of your humanity to participate in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the poor, you know, people who like go through all this stuff and become citizens of the United States, and it means so much to them, but it's only because they don't really know how the political process, the power of the political process, what it really means and who runs it. I mean, if the truth of the country was presented to them, the last thing in the world they would ever do would take an oath of allegiance, right? They would take an oath of rebellion. So I think the same thing is correct here, is that the family structure, I mean, in other words, if you had a natural world, right, where you had families and ethnicities and you didn't have federalism, then I think that the author of those positions, he would make perfect sense, because he would basically be talking about the power that a woman has inside of a healthy family, and which is inside of a healthy ethnicity, right? And that is something that is not only, I think, would be satisfactory, but is actually the fullest manifestation of the humanity of a woman, right? But the problem is that isn't being offered to them, and it's not being offered to the male. With federalism, you're being offered fake money. And of course, since World War II, even your ethnicity has been taken away. So what really can protect a woman now? You know, they would cling to the vote at this point, because the things that he's talking about have all been taken away and shattered.
Yeah, right? I do think some of the things he predicts, did come true. Obviously, the woman out of the home and children in daycare are being neglected, and obviously the effects of the divorce rate that occurred in the second half.
Yeah. What year did he write that?
1911.
Nostradamus. Nostradamus. He saw it.
But I do think he's generally correct in sort of mannish, you know, women politicians. They're playing a man's game. And it's the same thing, yeah, convincing women, appealing to their vanity and perhaps their narcissism and I mean, this is, you know, I mean, to go out and have a career and work and do interesting things, as Isaac Asimov said, as if raising a child isn't interesting, raising a family.
Exactly.
You know, and that this is the problem, and you get them out in that field, and it ruins them. It ruins them, and, you know, because what they're destroying the institutions and the protections that we have against the forces of Masonic, you know, corruption or the corporate state, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, and we saw that, you know, in the second half of the 20th century. The logic of the system itself, that we're reaching the reductio ad absurdum of it all now. But it's sort of baked into the cake. And you're correct, because he's thinking as if you have the Republic and this is how you defend freedom and protect individual rights. And I think structurally, yes, having the family and having the father as the patriarch, you know, represent the family, these sort of distant representative systems and how politics works. We need to turn politics into have a human scale to it to function properly. And the United States, beginning... Exactly right. You know, I think you had oligarchs in the United States from the get-go. The problem is it was too large and decentralized and to control everything. But as technology improved in the Civil War and the country was centralized, it became practical, which is why by the late 19th century, you had, you know, the robber barons and these things. And they're creating foundations and they're endowing universities and they're creating mass media. And these things are going to capture the imagination of all the American people. And they're going to be indoctrinated and thinking what the good life is, and, you know, how they're free because they can consume in these things. So, I mean, yeah, you're going against, you know, basically criticizing the woman's vote is like criticizing, you know, the birth control pill. It's considered, you know, as an alloyed good thing. And I take a contrary point of view in both matters. And I just don't think that, I think the more political activist, you know, it's one of the things, it's the nature of things. And, I do think that women do exert a lot more healthy influence when they take a step back. Notwithstanding that there are a few very effective female political activists, Phyllis Schlafly being one. But for every one Phyllis Schlafly, there's, you know, 1,000 Gloria Steinem wannabes. I don't think it's worth it. So.
No, I mean, and, you know, I have often had this discussion, you know, with various people that I know and stuff, and I have the hardest time getting them to see my point, which is that when you look at the birth control pill or women's suffrage, mm-hmm. okay, you have the concept that they present of, you know, this is the worker's paradise, these are freedoms and things like that.
Yeah, it's false independence.
Yeah, it's hard to get them to analyze these things as part of an operation that's malevolent, mm-hmm. because they have been conditioned into seeing them as their freedom. They've been conditioned into saying, oh my God, without abortions, birth control pills, and feminist political leaders, we're screwed. We would be wiped out. And we look at the male political leaders, and they're so corrupt and evil, without our group, we would be, you know, at their mercy. And they don't understand that the whole structure of reality, right, that the male political leaders are, like, you know, Trump, I mean, are being presented as ways to keep them inside the dialectic. This is the slave system.
Yeah.
And so to try to get them to see, well, there's another way to live. You know, and that way of living wouldn't involve federalism. I mean, somehow the guerrillas are able to, like, function as a social order without, a president and a Congress. They're just natural sorts of social organizations and structures that, you know, can actually relate to basically the nature that we have, which I think is crushed, and not just the, you know, the kind of guerrilla, like, animal nature, but the spiritual nature is crushed. You know, you look at, like, Nancy Pelosi, there's a really good YouTube on the relationship between, you know, the Newsom family, Pelosi family, Governor Brown, mm-hmm. And one other, but these are the California oligarchs, and it shows that how inbred they are. And how Pelosi's dad or grandfather was a Sicilian P2 Masonic, you know, who knows what, but he was certainly, you know, an opium runner, and he was part of the Black Hand. And so when you get, then when you get his, you know, granddaughter being your feminine representative, it does, she's just a Mason with a, you know, with a wig on. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no, you're not being given a choice. And yet they would defend her as a woman. You know, at least Hillary Clinton, finally we're getting a woman in to be president. These are the thoughts of slaves, you know, that have been fooled.
Yeah, and you have a same with the AOC, right?
Yeah.
Or Kamala Harris, who, you know, who slept her way to, you know, to her position.
Yeah, I mean, California is just, you know, it's just a long-standing Masonic cesspool. Mm-hmm. San Francisco is probably the most openly Masonic town in the United States, and it's other than Washington D.C. And it's you know, it's why, you know, they basically set MK Ultra loose there, you know, because this was where they had enough control where they could interject the most destructive parts of the youth culture, feminism. You know, this was where they had the control, and so this is where they ran the original experiments and social structure catastrophes, which, you know, Silicon Valley, and now with Burning Man, which began there as well. I mean, so,
well, you know, I mean, when society was less advanced and more in tune with nature and more primal, it was, you know, the community, the village, you know, the tribe was defended by the men. And if you understand politics as being another form of warfare, warfare being an extension of politics, this is the realm for the men, because they decide public policy that ultimately defends and preserves, the village or the culture, the nation. And domestic was women, and that's how it was broken down.
And when there are not roles and places for men to basically manifest, you have shattered your culture.
Yeah.
And we're headed toward, and it's being done for a slave state. So the point being is, if politics, as it is a way to control and defend, you know, a region, if it is expressed in that form, in its natural form, then it wouldn't be something women would even be interested in. It wouldn't be something that would reach into the family structure, into the, you know, street life of the community. It would be something that men were supposed to perform. You see, there would be a sexual dimorphism. There would be, like, you know, males are bigger, they have testosterone, mm-hmm. They're supposed to behave like this. And it would defend the people inside it, the women and children, in a far more, you know, satisfying and beneficial way than the federal government ever could. You see, so this is the normie female has a hard time, I think, you know, looking at this often, that you really want areas that are separated to the sexes, because that is how nature, this is obviously part of how we would operate in the natural world. And we can't have a world that's really healthy that doesn't have some of these attributes. You know, these attributes are not reflected in it.
Yeah, and again, if you're talking about, if you want to move towards a society where the government is more accountable and that you have, you know, rule of law and justice, the vote is not the way to promote that. The vote is irrelevant if you have a Judeo-Masonic secretive banking system. You have an elite that's able to, you know, manipulate the currency and impose a currency and then manipulate it and create clandestine or, you know, a cryptocracy with secret agencies that have no accountability in these things. And so having the vote is meaningless, and you would go a lot. This is why, you know, there's, like I said, I alluded to it earlier. The irony is, as they expanded the franchise, they created secretive government that was beyond the vote anyways. And
it was part and parcel.
Yeah.
They had to do that because that was how they could have more and more people so-called in the fake democracy and still have control. Mm-hmm. They just removed these things from being in part of the democratic process. That's why the CIA and all the secret government societies now are outside of the realm of what, you know, like, you know, that our representatives aren't even involved. They wouldn't even be able, the Congress people, if there was such, that would ever came out of, like, a, you know, in a natural election that was representing community, he would have no access to the CIA. he'd have no control there or be able to. I mean, look at the projects that they put on, like MK Ultra. Mm-hmm. They have their idea about how to control society, and they're executing it. Democracy is just part of it. What we have is democracy. So, you know, suffrage is, you know, it has been part of our overall cultural destruction and enslavement. And I don't think that destroying suffrage, like, in other words, if the idea that, well, let's get rid of women's ability to vote, this is going to help us at this point. God, I mean, I can't imagine that that would actually bring anything that would be useful. What would be useful would be to start creating families again.
Well, ultimately, a political program towards, I think, again, returning politics to a more human scale, decentralization, the destruction, you know, if we somehow were to do away with these secretive bureaucracies, whether it's the Pentagon or the Central Intelligence Agency or the other 15 other secret agencies, 15 or so secret agencies in these things. Yeah, the Federal Reserve banking system in these things. Yeah. And you would find that, again, the drive for mass democracy wouldn't be there, because that's always been promoted as a means to create the illusion of participation. But, yeah, like I suggested earlier, if you had a system where, you know, if we're going to have a federal government, if it was more along the lines of the original plan of just, the, you know, sort of a, you know, a common market and a mutual defense pact, and pretty much leaving the most things up to the states, and you have a president, and the state legislatures would elect this president every 4 years. We wouldn't be stuck with a 2-year presidential campaign every this endless cycle. And we could, you know, there'd be less of a puppet show to watch. Maybe people will be more involved in their affairs. It's funny, interesting. They've done studies about who's better informed. And on national, global affairs, men are far better informed than women. They read more about these things. But when you get to local things, women become more informed. So there's that domesticity, right? The terms, the concern for the domestic in these things. So they approach politics differently.
Also, it shows that federalism is just as a political concept is a horrible idea, because you get one single entity supposedly in these different areas that it's controlling.
Yeah.
But it isn't a natural controller of both domestic and foreign policy. I mean, mm-hmm. even if it was sane, it would be like ill designed. And you need to get rid of it. I mean, look, just remember that, you know, Peyton Randolph, who with Ben Franklin were the two highest Masonic representatives in the United States, right? They were mm-hmm. the Grand Masters of Pennsylvania and I believe Virginia. They were the people who were our first elected representatives, right? They were the ones who actually, ran the Congressional Congress. And then Peyton Randolph was actually elected as the president. He was just too old to continue. And then you had George Washington. I mean, just look at the picture of the guy being sworn in with his Masonic apron on, you know. So look, this was obviously at that time a Masonic project. And the idea that they would ever let go of this control is preposterous. They never let go. So when you see, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton, you don't have anything that's, in contradiction to the organization that produced Peyton Manning and George Washington. It's the same organization. It's just now it has different ways of confusing the population and keeping them in line, and different dialectics to confuse people. The two things that can be done are, you know, participate in the information revolution, right? Just don't be intimidated. Bring up these subjects. Just don't let it slide. YouTube, their anti-First Amendment, kind of slaughter this week was a really good example of the ideas that need to be discussed, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're all for voting, but they don't want people voting to be informed.
Right. And so they're helping us. So there's that. And then the other thing is just to live a natural life, right? To actually find in yourself find the kind of community that you can express yourself naturally. This is a really tough thing to do, but it is possible. And that is, you know, first of all, with family, and then with extended community, and then with ethnic, you know, connection. This is the natural world we come from. And so when when you simply return to the obvious structure of society that we have been part of for a very, very long time, of course your life is going to be better, you see? And of course you'll be able to defend yourself better, right? Because you're part of a group.
Yeah. And you have more democracy if you, you know, if you, to the extent that people mean that, self-government, you know, people.
Yeah, you'd have more impact on events.
Not just voting, but you buy local food distributors, local farmers and these things, you get a greater measure of independence from sort of the globalized system. That's far more effective than, you know, getting into the, going to.
Absolutely. Going, you know, and it's just like that's, booth. Yeah. And these are changes that I've made in my life. So it can be done. I mean, we try to get food, nothing but from organic and local areas. We're very lucky here in Santa Barbara because we've got like, you know, 100 organic farmers. And I know most of these people. I've been out to the farm. So, you know, you get a good sense of trust.
Here's how it would work. This is how you should have undermined their system. Is that if a man and a woman get married and they're both, say, more traditional, more natural in their outlook, meaning the man's going to provide and protect, the woman's going to raise and nurture the children, these things. So she's at home, he's at work. A woman isn't tempted or doesn't want to go out. She wants to raise the children. So the labor market has less labor to exploit. So the wages go up. So he's more able to take care of her at home. The home is intact. She's raising the children. Should they decide, well, maybe we'll send them to a local public school. There's an intact family, maybe more people doing this. There's a network of intact families that share common values and concerns, and they can go to the local school board and raise concerns about mandatory vaccines or the transvestite and working there or the curriculum, these things. And so should they voice their opposition and not get their way, they, because they have an intact family and perhaps they know a network of intact families, they can drop out of the school system and homeschool. So at that point, the school system becomes irrelevant. So that is great. And because they've supported these traditional, reverted or they've embraced these traditional roles, which is the ultimate source of strength, they're able to resist the system without having to, man the barricades or start a civil war over it.
That's right, because banning the barricades and starting the civil war is it would be a little hard to organize that at this point, and it will occur in a political sense just naturally if enough people actually go forward with the information revolution.
Yeah, well, a good example is a mother has a problem with a kid or one of the teachers. They don't like what's being taught at the school, and she goes to complain, and they just tell her to take a hike. You got no option. Well, like I said earlier, you can just pull the kid out, and then she has a husband that'll back her up. And that way, and again, and there was a time when more people lived in families like that, so they could exert control or they could exert opposition. They can't do that now with this, atomized, broken families, and
I was fascinated. One of the things that they characterized as the hate speech they were pulling the plug on YouTube was a 911.
Yeah, well, they said promoting Nazi ideology and ideas that 9/11 didn't happen.
Yeah, that didn't happen. It was
poor writing. But what do they mean by not happening? You mean like you don't agree with the narrative? You have a problem?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, these ideas are so crackpot, why are they so dangerous?
Yeah, well, that's right. But this.
By the way, you can go on YouTube. I don't see any. They're not banning videos talking about alien invasion or lizard people.
No, I don't think so. And I've never heard anyone who promotes Nazi ideology. I think that's how they express it. And also was claiming that 9/11 didn't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the whole thing is just so obvious to me that there is a little bit of tension here because they can see that, like, particularly 9/11, which is, you know, it was kind of the beginning of the alt media in many ways, is becoming uncontrollable. I'm really waiting for, just someone on mainstream media to just say, I'm a truther and I just think you're crazy if you aren't. And just see what happens.
I noticed that about a year ago, they started posting disclaimers if we were to talk about something like the Kennedy JFK assassination, or 9/11, or some other event, they'd post the standard, you know, the official story, a synopsis of it.
They would have it there, like this immediate mind control to like make sure that the chief.
It's like, wait a second, this is my video. I mean, come on, what percentage of the population actually believes that JFK was assassinated by a lone nut? Because Walter Cronkite said so. But they're going to insult everyone's intelligence by putting it out there, despite the fact that I would say maybe as many as 2/3 don't buy that anymore. Yet this is the cognitive dissonance that we're faced, you know, forced to swallow.
Well, they're trying now to, like, you can see they've recognized that the internet wasn't exactly what they hoped for. There's no question that somewhere along the line, the force was disrupted, because they now have to do stuff like, you know, the YouTube, you know, kind of slaughter of anything that's doing, you know, thinking outside the box. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're behind the curve. There's just too many people now that have been like listening to all the little hundreds of people talking about this stuff. And when they get ham-handed like this, oh man, I don't know. Maybe they can pull it off and they can just keep the intimidation going. But I've been saying, just based on the kind of, you know, communication I get from the internet and whatnot, I think it's pretty close to actually collapsing. And I just don't know what would happen if you had like a broad scale information revolution where, you know, just people just started speaking out saying the media is fake. You know, so this is completely fake. And 9/11 was an inside job. I mean, if this stuff started to always be in the presence of crowds that were being, you know, like filmed and things. Oh man, I don't know. We'll get to see, Tim, maybe like how they can keep it all together. But I'm voting with the people. I'm voting with the First Amendment, and I think, you know, they have to let these ideas out and let the people decide as to, you know, who has the stronger argument.
That's true, because even if you do believe that the 19th Amendment should not be repealed, it's the First Amendment that makes the 19th Amendment, you know,
mean anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go back to the First Amendment, start there. So, yeah. So anyway, it's, I think, frankly, I'm just sitting here, Tim, and I think the future is bright. I think that YouTube can do whatever they damn please. And I think now you're going to see that people just do workarounds.
Yeah, that's going to happen. Yeah.
They're just going to start doing workarounds. In fact, I was actually reading somewhere, this one guy was saying, look, let me have your email address, and I'm just going to get my information out as email broadcasts. You know, there's just too much information out there now in the internet. I mean, man, oh man, I hope I live long enough to see a real information revolution.
Well, yeah, now, and this was, I was listening to E. Michael Jones talk, and his magazine Culture Wars, you know, he still prints it and does PDF, and you can buy it either the print form or PDF form, and they just email it to you. And that could be a way to, you know, if, you know, as more people realize that they're the platforms like YouTube are censoring, more people will revert to that type of distribution, and then you'll probably get a push to deny people email service if they're
right. Of course they will. And but the thing is, at a certain point, it's sort of like the financial model for YouTube. If they just keep, you know, getting rid of everything, then the whole device, which was supposed to be this mind control perfection, is just destroyed.
Yeah, the whole commerce angle, because commerce is how they draw you in, convenience, and you can't have the smooth movement of commerce by trying to. And YouTube's an example of this, where they're destroying its basic business model in the interest of censorship. And they do the same thing to the internet, and all of a sudden, once they lose the internet, that's a huge method of control and manipulation. So they're kind of in a double bind themselves in these things.
They are, and we're gonna keep squeezing.
So, okay, Joe, let you go.
Thanks for the discussion. We'll start squeezing again first thing next week.
Enjoy your weekend.
Okay, you too. Bye bye.
Bye bye.